trying to tell me that I can dodge bullets?
No, Neo. I'm trying to tell you that when you're ready, you won't have to.
Hey, everybody out there in podcast land. This is Johnny Has the Keys with Tim and David. We're glad to be back with you this week. Hey, David, how are you doing?
I'm good, Tim. How are you?
I'm good. It's been a great week and day so far.
Excellent.
A lot of fun stuff going on this time of year. What's been going on in your world?
Nothing really major. I've been traveling and doing a lot of work this week, so I've been trying to catch up on some stuff on flights and things like that. One of the things I wanted to say about my, you know, what's new or what's happening in my week, like we normally do at the beginning of it, is
what's happening in your genre related week, David?
In my genre related week is. The struggle that I think writers, and maybe you can elaborate on this since you are a writer. Okay. I've always said I'm not a writer, but I'm a really good rewriter. But the struggle that writers face in ending a story, because as everybody knows, this is the last year for Game of Thrones. So they're doing their, you know, final wrap ups last season, got to tie all those loose ends, you know, whatever. This is the final season for, or the final movie for Star Wars is this year, so they're wrapping up nine movie. Yeah, me. Yeah, so true. Oh, so true. Well, and I guess the final story in the Skywalker saga sort of thing. And so far I've been very disappointed in what I've seen, what I've read, everything, and how these writers are tying up their stories and ending them. You know, there have been series in the past, too, where like people talk about Dexter. I never watched Dexter, but it was extraordinarily popular, and then somebody said the last season they just destroyed it. They just screwed it all up in the way they did the last season. You know, The Sopranos, a great series, and it ended with all this ambiguous questions and what's happening and whatever.
It's so funny. That was going through my head the entire time you were talking. I was thinking, wow, remember
right.
The Sopranos last episode?
Yeah. And you know, I'm afraid Game of Thrones is gonna turn out to be, you know, at the very last scene, Ned Stark is gonna wake up and go, "Oh, I had a bad dream," you know, like like they did back with what was the series? You know, the one where he woke up.
Who?
Well, you had Dallas. Dallas, you had the, it was all in the shower dream thing. Remember how the way Dallas ended?
Yeah,
it was Bobby's.
Yeah.
It was like Bobby's dream, and then Bob Newhart ended.
Bob
with,
Newhart, exactly.
It was all
I was going to say that too. Yeah.
You know, so those are classic, I guess, bad ways or whatever, or lazy writing. I call it lazy writing.
Well, actually, the Bob Newhart one was pretty brilliant. But
correct.
The I don't think the JR one was at all. And in all honesty, I don't hate the Sopranos ending. I kind of like the FU to everybody he did with it, because it was basically he basically was saying, look, these characters are going to live on and they'll always live on in your world. So enjoy it. Why should I do something, you know, that's spectacle by just destroying them and ending the series that way? I kind of like the way they just sat down to dinner and it ended. That one really didn't bother me. I got lots of fights with people about that. Yeah.
Well, and I'm wondering if all of the opinions of the world, you know, naturally we're an opinion podcast too, but
correct.
You know, does that influence it? Like, you look at Lost, you know, I personally liked Lost's ending. I thought the whole purgatory thing was a cool idea. But
another one, I
didn't.
Liked that one too. And a lot of people got in fights with me about it, but I had no problem with that ending.
But I mean, you know, it's just struggling. I mean, I'm just struggling with it, thinking about how writers do it. I mean, even think about, you know, your masters. You know, I think King struggled with the end of it.
Oh my God!
I don't like the end of The Stand. You know, I just it's interesting that great writers just seem to not know how to end the story.
Yeah. Well, and this is really a Pandora's box you've opened. We could probably do a whole podcast just on this subject alone.
I'm sure.
I want to argue that in a creative case, it could be the balance of the scales between the studio and the artist, because the studio wants more money and more installments, and the artist has a vision, you know, that's a beginning and an end. But then, like you said, you can bring Stephen King up, who has had many o'clunker of endings. I mean, he has had some really bad ones. Now, I saw an interview with him the other day, or heard one. Actually, that could be a new thing, too. I just realized he had an interview with Mick Garris this week. He defends a lot of them. He's like, you know what? They're my endings. I own them. So I'm like, well, at least, you know, he owns them. Uh-huh. I don't know if that's a cheap way of saying, yes, yeah, some of them suck or not. He just, you know, I don't know.
Right. Right. So, yeah, that's what I've been doing this week, is just struggling with the whole, you know, how do writers end epic stories if, you know, because you can't please everybody, you know that, but at least you could stay true to your characters or your vision or your logic or whatever. And I don't see that happening a lot.
In the stuff that I've written, or at least here lately, I'm kind of a fan of the quiet coda. You know, I kind of like having a big bang and then, you know, an afterward. That's like
an epilogue.
Exactly. That's kind of my approach. Or at least right now it is anyway. So.
Well, and that, you know, going back to King, you know, The Shining, great example of that. You know, we have the huge, huge finale, and then there's that last little coda epilogue part with, you know, them at the dock, you know, talking to each other or whatever. So there's a little bit of that survivor after thing.
You're talking about the book.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not the movie. Which is another thing Steve has a big beef with, but we won't get into that here.
All right. What about you? What have you been doing?
Well, I actually, I've been putting it off a little bit because it's kind of bittersweet. IFC has been broadcasting, Joe Lansdale's Happen Leonard series. It's based on a series of books written by Joe Lansdale. He's got like 20 of them about these, good old boys in Texas that always managed to get into a lot of trouble. And they pulled the plug after three seasons, so I'm a little bit sad because it was really a great show, and they're on Netflix now if anybody's interested. So I started it this week, and it's fantastic. All of them have been great. So I'm like, why did you have to cancel this? Why can't Netflix pick it up? So,
Okay. Yeah.
It's about
Hap and Leonard. What'd you call it?
It's called Hap and Leonard. Hap is white, Leonard is black, Hap is straight, Leonard is gay, and Hap is a draft dodger, and Leonard is a Vietnam vet.
So there's too much conflict in this story already.
Well, they're best friends, though. They grew up together as kids, and they're good old boys from East Texas. It is set in like the 80s and 90s because of the fact that he was a Vietnam vet, so I'm guessing that's why they have to take it back a little bit. It's just good stuff. It's not genre per se, although sometimes there's a little bit of mystical stuff to them. Like the second installment is Mucho Mojo is the name of it, because there's a little bit of black magic supposedly going on, a little bit of voodoo. But yeah. Anyone. If you haven't read Joe Lansdale, I highly recommend him to anybody out there. He's written in just about every genre you can imagine. He even did a movie many of our listeners may have seen called Bubba Hotep, which is basically about a mummy in an old folks' home with Elvis and a black dude that thinks he's JFK.
Love it.
That's a great story, too. So.
Bruce Campbell. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, can't go wrong with Bruce Campbell. Yeah, cool. He does a good Elvis.
Well,
so we want to talk about, I guess, today's subject. We're back on the sci-fi track. How's it feel?
Darn right. It's good. There's nothing running toward me, chasing me with implements. And well, there actually are people running and chasing in this, but it's not the the terror that one would feel from a zombie or something of that nature, a monster.
Not quite. I don't know, man. If an agent was after me, it'd be pretty scary, I would think.
Well, yeah, very true. Very true.
I was just going to say, in the movie that we are talking about is 1999's The Matrix. You want to give us a brief little summary of it there, David?
Yeah, I've got a little snippet that they said in 1999. The movie stars Keanu Reeves as Neo, a hacker recruited by a rebellion to aid them in the fight against machines who have taken over the world and placed humanity inside a simulated reality called the Matrix. Which is a pretty good setup for it. I mean, I've got to say, from the sci-fi standpoint, I would think that this movie, Keanu Reeves aside, which I'm sure we'll get into, but this movie is a milestone in sci-fi cinema. It runs to me, it's along the lines of 2001 or Star Wars, Blade Runner. It sets its own world up in a really cool idea, and I think they established the whole genre of cinema, of science fiction paranoia, question the reality around you, and did it in a really cool way. I like this movie. I got to admit, I do. And like I said, despite Keanu, because those of you who know me know that I hate Keanu Reeves. I think he is absolutely terrible. He is one of the luckiest actors in history to have no talent and still do the amount of films that he does.
Wow. Whoa.
Whoa. Dude.
I like to refer to this movie as Neo's Excellent Adventure.
Perfect.
I'm not a big Keanu Reeves fan too, but there have been a couple of movies that he was passable in, and I definitely think this is one of them. Speed.
Oh, I can't deny there's a lot of movies. Yeah, there's a lot of movies he's done I really like, but I have to like overlook him in it. You know, Bram Stoker's Dracula, Speed, this. I mean, I'm just going, dang. And then everybody keeps telling me to watch
John Wick.
New one. Wick.
Yeah. I haven't seen it either, and all I read are great things about it. So I kind of want to see it. And now there's three of them.
But you also read a lot of good things about Fast and Furious too, and they're not any good. You know, so there's that. I just
don't have any interest. They remind me of those Jean-Claude Van Damme movies of the 80s, you know. They're kind of B-level movies. I don't know. Everyone in audience land, please don't persecute me for saying this. But they just don't interest me. But yeah, I see what you mean.
No, I mean, I'm the same way. I have several friends who just love Fast and Furious, whatever they're on now, 9, 12, 19, whatever.
Yeah, too many.
Yeah, but they don't interest me at all. I get literally nothing out of them. And I don't know if I would get that out of Wick. I mean, basically a vengeance story where he kills 80 people. You know, okay, maybe, I guess. I've got to end up trying it. I just, you know, even in this movie, so even in Matrix, I saw a stat where over 2/3 of his lines in this movie are questions.
Yeah, I saw that too. All I could think of was Bill and Ted.
Yeah, if you have him roaming around all befuddled, going, what? Huh?
What?
What?
Yeah.
Yeah. What?
How? Yeah,
then it might.
Who?
Yeah.
Where?
But the movie itself, I mean, as an objective, you know, not looking at performances, so just as an overall, I think the movie has some incredibly great ideas. I think it's very well filmed. It's written and directed by Lana and Lily Wachowski.
Who, is that how you say it? I thought it was Wachowski.
It might be Wachowski. Yeah. It might be Wachowski. I don't know. It's one of, but it's it, one of those.
I think it's Wachowski, like Chow, the dog. But I what
Wachowski? Yeah. Okay, Wachowski. So the brothers Wachowski, which is what they're basically referred to now.
No, they were not then, and now they're the sisters.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Now they're the sisters.
Yeah,
that's right.
they're Hollywood, as far as I know. they're Hollywood's first transgender directing team. Actually, probably the only trans directing team.
Yes, I would probably agree with that.
But yeah, maybe not the only trans director that I'm aware of. So,
but you know, they had a brilliant eye with this. This was only their second movie. They had done Bound before this, which I remember watching on videotape, you know, back in the day, and mm-hmm. I actually liked it. But this like catapulted them huge, led to, you know, the sequels, several other movies, and eventually led to a series that I know you and I both like, Sense8. Yes, which exactly. is them teaming up with one of my favorite writers, J. Michael Straczynski, and doing an incredible series that should have had a longer life than what Netflix gave it or whomever.
Yeah, it was an expensive show, but I love that show.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant.
It was a little indulgent, and it was a little titillating. That may be why I liked it as well. Lots of pretty people running around with a lot less clothing.
Yes, there is that. I think they've, all of their movies, you know, if you look back at it, thinking about taking them as auteurs now or as the people, I was looking back at, like, you know, Cloud Atlas and Jupiter Ascending, and all of them are about this human experience. You know, how do you deal with your own human experience and how you interact with other people and this whole, there's something more to humanity than what you think it is. That seems to be a subtext in all their movies.
I would say that has a lot to do with them being transgender.
Yeah.
And that essentially is a key. I can't come up with a word for it, but a real life key in that, you know, they probably felt they were trapped in bodies that were not their own, and they were looking for ways to explore outside the bounds of the body.
That makes sense.
And that is a running theme, I think, in a lot of their work.
Well, yeah. In Cloud Atlas and Sense8, definitely in Jupiter Ascending, but and in this piece, the whole Matrix thing. You know?
I mean, the whole thing with Keanu waking up in the pod, or Keanu, however you say his name, waking up in the pod, you know, to reality.
Yeah, yeah, this is your reality.
Yeah.
So when was let's start at the beginning. Then when was the first time you saw this movie? When was the first time you saw it?
I have a hard time remembering if I saw it in the theater. I don't think I did. I think I saw it on DVD when it was released. And I actually worked for Borders at that time. So I probably bought it when it came out and watched it that night, would be my guess.
Okay. I'm the same way, sort of. I cannot remember the first time I saw it. I do remember when it came out, I was traveling. I think I may have been in Japan somewhere, or I may have been in LA. But anyway, I was traveling, and I know all of my clique of friends and everybody else back home and everything all went at the same time, one showing. Like 16 people went to see this movie and came out of it going, oh my gosh, it's incredible, it's great, da, 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 you got to see it. So I remember going to see it, and I didn't like it at all. I left the theater going, really? And I guess I was in a critical mood, like I never am, but I was in like a very critical kind of mood and just didn't appreciate it, or my Keanu was really kicking in bad.
I could see both, and I've actually seen movies in the wrong mood before and misinterpreted them, so I know where you're coming from.
And then, like, I guess a few months later ended up seeing it again and saying, okay, now I can appreciate, you know, if I overlook Keanu, and I think I can appreciate a lot of what they're trying to do in this movie. I still think it has some huge logic issues all the way through it. But they're trying to set up a whole new world, you know, a whole new perspective, essentially.
A whole new world.
You and Disney. You know, I mean, well, in talking about the movie in general, it did do very, very well. Like we said, it spawned sequels. It spawned an animated series. It won 4 Academy Awards.
Yeah,
it
sure did.
I think it made stars out of Lawrence Fishburne and Hugo Weaving that they had never been before. I think it elevated them a great deal.
I think it elevated them. They were already on my map, though. Fishburne had done he had done Pee-wee's Playhouse for one thing. And then Hugo Weaving was in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And that had already been on my radar. So,
really? What was he in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert?
He's the lead. He's one of the three drag queens. Yeah.
Wait.
Oh, yeah.
I thought the drag queens were Kurt Russell and...
No. Well, first of all, you're thinking...
Patrick Swayze.
No, you're thinking of To Wong Fu, which is an American ripoff of
Priscilla. Oh, okay.
Yeah, Priscilla is an Australian film that had Guy Pearce, Terrence Stamp, and Hugo Weaving in it.
Oh, well, then I stand corrected.
And I mean, Hugo Weaving, Terrence Stamp, and Guy Pearce versus Patrick Swayze, John Leguizamo, and...
Wesley Snipes.
I mean, by comparison, I mean, you know, I think the former is a little bit higher elevated already. So, anyway. True. And it was made in Australia, okay. And so was The Matrix. So there.
There you go. They were connected.
No argument.
Well, so how do we want to jump into this? You want to think, you want to talk about it from like sections, like best parts? You want to talk about from writing, from performance?
Let's talk a little bit about the origins and history and then maybe move on to the cast.
Sure.
And scenes.
Okay.
I will say that the Wachowskis, we're never going to be able to pronounce that right, apparently harbored this idea for 5 years and there were 14 scripts written, which... It makes me think, I mean, one of my keys that I'll get to later is the whole cyberpunk thing. I'm not a big sci-fi guy, not as much as you are, but I do remember when I lived with you, a copy of William Gibson's Neuromancer was always in the bathroom. I do remember that.
Yep.
And a lot of this movie is kind of connected with Neuromancer. And it makes me just wonder if the Wachowskis were these, you know, teenagers reading all this cyberpunk stuff saying, we got to write the script, man, you know, and they just let it gestate until they came up with this thing that's pretty damn perfect, at least visually. I don't know. What do you think as far as the evolution of the genre itself? I mean,
I think it's heavily influenced by Neuromancer. Okay. Neuromancer was a huge influence, I think, on them. It almost is it's not that they're telling his story, but they've definitely set everything in his world. I also think they tapped into something that, to me, I've always thought of Matrix as like a live action Philip K. Dick novel that was never made. You know, Philip K. Dick is the guy that did Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. Most of his, he was certifiably mentally ill, and his stories all dealt with paranoia, all dealt with, you know, covert agencies taking over your mind, or your mind being the reality that you know is not what you know. And this is, you know, essentially his style of story all the way through this.
That's funny because I have in my notes that William Gibson used the term Matrix in Neuromancer, but when asked about this movie, he says himself, this movie is closer to a Philip K. Dick novel. Those are his exact words.
But I think it's a cool weave of those two, Hugo Weaving, of those two, because Gibson's was the world they created, you know, and using whatever they did... either post or pre-production to give this whole movie that green tint. Everything has kind of the blue sucked out of it. It has a real greenish tint in their reality world. And the whole references to being jacked in, to reading code, to seeing falling lines of code that can determine, you know, your reality. That's all Neuromancer.
Okay.
But this whole, the underlying story of you're living in a false reality and you have to accept this other reality if you want to survive is all Philip K. Dick. And the agents, the whole, you know, that they're that kind of inspiration. I mean, basically, like to your point, I did not know they had that many screenplays, but it would be interesting because, you know, it's basically almost point for point the hero's journey all the way through this movie.
Very much so. A lot of my keys are from ancient literature.
Well, yeah, they definitely. I have several of those. That they obviously took things. You know, they were, and I don't know. Was it intentional? They wanted to create their own kind of mythos, sort of thing, by going back to mythic names and mythic, you know, story points. I don't know. It definitely worked for them. I mean, it gave them two other sequels, none of which meet up to this, but.
You know, I mean, who wouldn't want to meet someone named Morpheus? I mean, that's pretty fucking awesome.
Yeah, well, true. True.
Trinity, Neo, Cypher. I mean, they're really, you know, you could. This movie, you know, we talked about Keanu not being great, but actually being decent in this film. I think a lot of it is because he has a model quality to him as far as being slender and attractive and very model-esque. And everybody in this movie, or at least the leads in this movie, are. I mean, Fishburne looks cool in that coat. And Carrie Ann Moss, is that her name? Carrie Ann Moss? I mean, she looks like a model. They look so stylish and so cool in this movie. And, I mean, the names suit them. They shouldn't have ordinary names. They should have very elevated names.
Yeah.
As far as the style.
True. I agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, so do you want to talk about some of the names and the meanings and what they mean? What about that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we were going to move on to cast, so that's cool. Let's just move on to the cast.
I mean, you've got, I mean, the ones that I've got in the notes, of course, Neo, which literally is a prefix meaning one. So that's kind of obvious that they did that. But Neo also means new. So right. I think that's kind of cool that they did that. I, as I will always state, just wish they had found someone else who could play that part. But he doesn't. It's not that it's not that he's terrible in it. It's just that there's no texture or nuance in him. He doesn't have a lot of that there's as a no performer, depth. So it doesn't show at all. Yeah,
he was not their first choice, by the way.
Oh, really? So let's go there. Who was it?
Well, originally, and I'm not sure if this is them or the studio. This could easily be the studio. Brad Pitt and Val Kilmer were originally tossed around.
Okay, I could see either one of them do that.
Yeah.
I think Kilmer would have more of an edge at that time in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. That would work for him. Yeah.
And then when they were out of the picture, I'm not sure why. It came down to either Johnny Depp or Keanu Reeves.
Okay.
And Depp has a little more depth, I would say. But
he now, does.
There were some other ones that are kind of surprising. Ewan McGregor turned it down.
Oh, see, there would have been that would have worked.
Right. Leonardo DiCaprio turned it down.
Okay.
Will Smith turned it down.
Good.
And his wife, his wife ended up being in the sequel, which is kind of funny. David Duchovny turned it down because he was filming X-Files, the movie, at the time.
Okay.
And Lou Diamond Phillips' agent told him it was going to be a flop. I thought that was hilarious.
So he fired him after it was over.
Probably yeah. So. So that's all I have as far as casting. I think Duchovny would have probably been about as stiff as...
Agreed.
Keanu. I don't think he would have been any better. I could definitely see Ewan McGregor or Johnny Depp or maybe even Leo doing it. I don't think Brad Pitt would have been that good in it either.
No, I agree with you. Yeah. I think he would be a lesser choice. I mean, Ewan would probably be my first out of that list of all of them. So names, okay. So and it's, you know, gentle listeners, it's not that. I hate Keanu. You know, yeah, it is. But it's not that he does a terrible job in this. It's that there is no nuance to everything he's doing. Everything is either what, who, whoa, ho, okay, okay, come on,
it's whoa. Fight.
You know, it's whoa. It's everything.
And he even has one in the movie when Morpheus jumps.
Oh, I know.
Whoa.
I think he has one in every movie. It's in his contract. You know, you have to add "woe" to his dialogue. But name, so Neo, his real name is Anderson, which I thought was interesting because translation of it is "son of man."
Correct,
which kind of makes sense there. Mm-hmm. So they've done a lot of this very the nomenclature, the names, everything are very mythic, like we said.
Yeah, there's a whole mythology going on for sure.
Yeah, Trinity, which basically you have a Trinity for most of the movie in Neo, Trinity, and Morpheus. So they're basically the Trinity of the movie anyway. Morpheus is Roman, I believe.
The Greek god of dreams.
Okay, I thought it was Roman, but either one. Roman, yeah, definitely god of dreams.
Mm-hmm. Which is ironic because he's trying to wake Neo up. Neo up, I can't speak.
Right.
Yeah.
And or to Neo, he's coming from a dream world anyway.
Correct.
You know, kind of the thing. Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting that they used a lot of semi-biblical references too. They used Zion is the name of the city of man, wherever that is in the original. We don't get to see it yet. They use the ship's name is Nebuchadnezzar,
yeah,
who was a Babylonian king.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go for this very bland kind of thing for the agents. The agents are Smith, Brown, and Jones.
Yeah.
So I thought, yeah, these whole nondescript could be one of a million people kind of things is ironic to, you know, name the agents that. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. I don't have much casting on Smith, but I do on Morpheus and Trinity.
Okay.
Well, let's start with Morpheus. Sam Jackson was considered. Russell Crowe and Chow Yun-Fat turned it down.
Ooh, it'd be interesting to have a Chinese. I hadn't thought of that as a mentor. Yeah.
And I like that it's very diverse. It's not that they're sticking to a stereotype. And Gary Oldman was considered as well. So you've got Asian, African-American, and white people being all considered for that role. It'd be interesting if they'd have done it female, too, but I don't see any evidence of that.
Yeah.
And then Carrie Ann Moss, who was fairly new at the time. I think she had done some television.
This is her first movie.
Yeah, I read where she had, like, twisted her knee, and she didn't tell anybody because she was afraid they would recast her.
Yeah, I remember that. She was afraid of losing the part.
Right.
So she didn't tell anybody.
And here's a little bit of an ironic punchline to my Neo casting. As far as Trinity, Sandra Bullock and Gillian Anderson both turned it down.
Huh.
Which, okay. You know, Gillian was with Duchovny on The X-Files, and of course Sandra had already done Speed with Keanu Reeves.
Right.
From what I read, Sandra turned it down when they were considering some of the earlier people, and she didn't think she would work well with them. So I'm thinking that might have been Pitt or Val Kilmer. Probably Val Kilmer. Jada Pinkett Smith auditioned, but didn't get cast until the following movie, I think, where she was Niobe. And this is the most surprising to me. Janet Jackson was asked to do the part, but she had scheduling conflicts.
Huh. That would be odd.
Yeah, it would have been. I think Carrie Ann Moss is pretty cool in it.
No, I actually think, I think she is perfect. She's probably, other than Morpheus, she's the best cast in this because she is a new face. We didn't know her. We didn't know anything about her. We had no presuppositions about her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's the one that really, you know, Morpheus is the mentor. He's the older, brilliant, wise one who teaches and trains. She's the one that's really the connection. You know, for us as audience members, she's the one that helps us make the connection to Neo and vice versa. And his connection to the world. And I think having an unknown in that part is pretty brilliant. I think that works really well.
Yeah. Morpheus is Obi-Wan.
Yeah. And that's odd. You know, one of the odd things I have written down is, you know, it's basically the hero's story almost all the way through, except the mentor doesn't die. You know, in a hero story, almost always the mentor dies or something happens to the mentor. He's taken away and you have to do it, you know, yourself. But Morpheus doesn't die.
No, because the hero gets a bunch of fucking guns and goes in and kicks ass.
Well, there's that, you know.
One last little thing that I did have. Another person considered that auditioned for Agent Smith, who I think could have probably been as good, is Christopher Maloney. I think he would have easily been a great agent in that movie, too.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
But he was a little bit young at the time.
I think Hugo Weaving does do a brilliant job, though.
Yeah, he does.
I think he's really, really good.
And it's amazing he didn't get recast because he had so many damn accidents in the movie.
He did?
Yeah.
Do tell.
He had some kind of cyst removed from his leg. He was having problems with his leg. So they had to shoot all his non-stunt-related scenes ahead so that he could heal. And then in one of his stunt things, I think he damaged his hip or something. I don't know. He was constantly getting hurt on this movie. Or was hurt when he began
really?
It. Yeah. Yeah. So they really liked him. They didn't want to lose him. So, oh, I did have one other note. Sean Connery was offered the architect in the sequels to this movie. And Michael Hutchence from In Excess was supposedly cast in a major role, so I don't know what role, but committed suicide 3 days later.
Because he got the role?
I don't know. But, well, he was all... I mean, he was effed up. He had a lot of things going for him. Wasn't he, like, married to Kylie Minogue or dating Kylie Minogue when all this shit happened?
Something like that. Yeah.
That was sad. Anyway, that was all my casting news. This is Casting Corner. Anything else about the names, like Cypher?
Cypher meaning how to translate or understand. I thought, and the other names are kind of nondescript in that, too. You got, what, Switch, Tank, Dozer, APOC. And they don't really fit in. It's like they focused on the first four and said, the rest of them just give them some funky cyber name.
Right. Well, it's like they're throwaways. You know, this is a red shirt. We'll just call them, you know, Switch.
Yeah. These are the red shirts.
I'm looking up Cypher right now, and it says it's a message in secret or to encode.
Yeah, mathematical.
Which means, I mean, that kind of explains the fact that he was the traitor or the Judas amongst them. What do you think about his casting? Speaking of Sopranos.
I liked him in that part. I think that's Joe, I can never pronounce his last name.
Pantaleano.
Pantaleano. I liked him in that. He had an edge to him from the very beginning, you know, Bye Bye Sweetheart and all that stuff from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. Although he does have one of the biggest plot holes in the movie.
Oh, he does?
Which is, we find out about him being the traitor by him having the big scene with Agent Smith. So he's in the Matrix, enjoying his wine and steak, and plotting with Agent Smith about, you know, becoming a traitor and turning them all in and setting up Morpheus and all that. And which is cool scene, nice and everything, until you think about it and go, okay, then how did he get in and out of the Matrix? Because they have to have a driver who lets you in and out of the Matrix, who monitors you while you're there, who sends you a phone call so you can get out. They've already set that up. They do it over and over again. That's the only way in and out. So how did you get in and out? If you're just, is Dozer sitting back there going, he just decided to take a little trip in the Matrix. I don't know where he is.
Maybe Mouse let him in to screw around with the red dress woman.
But still, you'd have to be monitored, and they can. Which is another thing too. There's a lot of. We'll get into that when we talk about plot holes. There's a lot of just you have to kind of go. Sure, okay, I accept that, even though you haven't done it before, but you can.
Sometimes you just have to let art flow over.
Flow over you? No. Yeah,
that's a Big Chill reference for anybody out there that doesn't know it.
I had this discussion actually a week ago, going back to, you know, decades ago, and you and I used to talk about the same thing, is I don't have a problem with you doing anything in your fantasy world you want to do as long as you obey the same rules in your fantasy world.
Right.
You can't set up one thing and then do something else, you know. So if you're, and especially you struggle if you're setting up in any form of reality, then it's something that we're used to, that we understand. But you have to then support that. You can't just arbitrarily change stuff just because, oh, I can, I'm the writer, I can make stuff up.
Right. No, that's the Joel Schumacher of filming. I mean, of writing or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, you have agents in this movie that are supposedly connected to some huge computer AI mainframe. They're incredible. They can morph into other people's bodies. They can do all this stuff, but they can't shoot a gun at all, it seems. They can't hit anyone with a gun, yeah, unless they need to. And then suddenly they can shoot the phone out of your hand or shoot Morpheus in the leg through a wall as he was running. In the rain from the sprinklers, you know, right. But there's just certain things that don't make.
Yeah, I was thinking like the whole helicopter scene with the Gatling gun. I'm like, there's four people in that room, and you're not hitting any of them, including Morpheus. So what the fuck, right, man? That's a lot. And you see the bullets falling from the helicopter, the casings.
Yeah. And how do you hit three of them but not Morpheus?
Right, he's stationary entire time.
So, yeah. Yeah, there's lots of those. I mean, there's just tons of these little plot holes and everything. I mean, even from the very beginning, you know, they establish, well, they kind of hint at it with the truck and Trinity, but they definitely establish later on that they can instantly morph into anybody. So why are they going up the stairs to get Trinity? Why don't they just morph into the three cops that are in the room with her?
Yeah.
It makes no sense, you know. There's all kinds of those little, you didn't think of that earlier? You didn't want to do that? What? Even the rules of the Matrix, you know, if you die in the Matrix, you die. Okay, cool. So if I get beat up in the Matrix, I spit up blood in the real world? Why would I do that? Because I'm not there, my body's convincing itself it needs to bleed. I'm not physically getting hurt. I'm mentally getting hurt, but not physically. You can jump buildings without breaking ankles or feet or anything, but a sword cut hurts you or a bullet kills you? There's certain things that don't make sense, you know.
Well, I think
it's... And they start going, oh, well, it's Neo. He can do anything. Oh, well, okay, sure, great. I guess that's your cop-out. Neo's Neo.
Hey, David, it's not your what, it's your when.
It's your when, yeah.
Free your mind. There is no spoon.
There is.
And I will give them that I will give them, is that you can become a superhero once you break those chains of realizing, you know, that you are more than human in there. But you're right. There are a lot of things that don't make sense. And I don't know that I could sit in a room with Wendell Thompson watching this movie. Because I'm sure he would let us know everything that was wrong about it.
That's true. Single thing. It would be crazy. I do think the plotting works really strongly, though. I do think they did a great job of sucking us into this world through Neo's eyes of he's the hero who has a destiny that's unfulfilled that he doesn't know. He's got to be mentored and trained. The way they do the betrayal and then the way they do the whole we're going back in, we're going to get Morpheus, which is one of my favorite scenes, by the way. I do love the scene in the lobby, yeah, with Neo and Trinity. That's a great sequence.
Well, it harkens back to great badass scenes, you know, like the Wild Bunch or anything like that. You know,
oh, yeah.
I mean? Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
It's like badass. That's a great are here. Let's get down to business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The movie is known for bullet time. You know, first time we see it is at the very in the very first scene with Trinity when she does the leap and she suddenly freezes in the air and the camera moves around her.
Yeah. And, you know, I have an interesting trivia on that this movie came out in 1999, And by 2002, that bullet scene was spoofed in over 20 different movies.
Huh. Makes sense.
I mean, the trivia said movies. I'm assuming they didn't mean movies. I'm thinking they meant like commercials and MTV and everything like that. But yeah.
Well, and from a sci-fi perspective, you know, I mean, that's why I say it's a milestone, because it did the same thing effects-wise that like the motion control camera did, you know, that started in Star Wars. Mm-hmm. You know, Lucas and ILM perfected that camera technology to be able to do all those model shots and everything, and it kind of changed the way special effects were done. Mm-hmm. You know, this did the same thing. Now they're even doing it at sporting events. You know, they have that same kind of effect is now in every NFL game, where they'll suddenly freeze the action and move the camera all the way around. It's done the same way. So effects-wise, they set precedence. You know, that scene... let's think about effects. So, of course, Keanu's, I've got to bend over defying gravity to dodge bullets, you know, literal bullet time. Mm-hmm.
I think that's the scene I was referring to, actually.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sure either one of those, or the scene at the end where he literally stops the bullets and they all drop and then he, you know, attacks, those kind of things were all just precedent setting at the time.
That's when he the knows whole fight. His win.
Yeah, the whole fight in the subway. You know, grabbing hold of Smith in midair, and then the camera goes all the way around them, kind of thing. That whole bullet time effect. And it reminded me, and I can't remember. I tried to think about it note wise, or I should have looked it up if it happened before or after. But there was a game that came out, was later turned into a terrible movie, but a game that came out called Max Payne. And in it, you have the ability to have that effect. You have bullet time. And they call it that, where you can literally click the button and your character goes into slow motion. So you can aim faster, hit more targets, or duck out of the way. And that was a key that it reminded me of. It reminded me of Max Payne.
Hmm.
Not sure if it was a key at the time or if Max Payne came after.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that at all.
Yeah.
Back to we were talking about FX. I read somewhere that 20% of this movie is visual effects. That's a lot.
That would make sense. Yeah. Well, remember, even a normal scene when they're in the modern day has to have some kind of effects added to it because everything turned green or has a green tint.
Right. Well, and I'm not sure if they're talking about something like as minor as that, but. Yeah, because if that was the case, it would be almost 100% of the movie. But
right,
maybe they're talking about as far as CGI.
Well, and you've got the whole the whole sequence of the birthing sequence, which is all special effects with the AI there and the all of the shots with the Nebuchadnezzar
with the octopus things. Yeah. Those
the programs, sentries or whatever. Yep.
And then I have various notes about how many days it took to shoot some of these scenes, like the lobby shootout. Okay,
those are good.
It's nothing spectacular. The lobby shootout took 10 days, and the opening action scene was preceded by 6 months of training and 4 days of shooting. But the 6 months of training was for the entire film, pretty much, because they all went through rigorous martial arts types training.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So
I mean, they would have to do the training programs and then to do the actual effects and the stunts.
Mm-hmm.
What about keys? You want to talk through some keys?
Sure. Okay. We already mentioned Morpheus is the god of dreams in Greek mythology, which is kind of ironic. The story itself is a modern adaptation of Plato's Allegory of the Cave, which is...
Of the what?
Allegory of the Cave. I didn't know much about this. I had to look into it, but it's about it's about these people living in a cave and studying the drawings on the wall and realizing that they are not within the world that they live in, that there's another world out there. I'm sure it's much more primitive in concept than to, you know, a cyberpunk science fiction classic, for lack of a better word. But it, you can definitely see the allegory. If you go to Wikipedia and look up Allegory of the Cave, and I'll post a link to it on the show notes, because I found it a little bit fascinating how much the story was an adaptation of it.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's really neat. I want to look that up.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple from the beginning. So definitely, you know, there's lots of references to Alice in Wonderland, too. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of keys with that, whether it's eat me, drink me, red pill, blue pill, follow the white rabbit.
You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
So several references to Alice, you know, he even says at one point, the world's going bye-bye, I think Cypher says, you know, wake up Alice or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I have a key at the beginning, when he's in his office, the only time we really see him in his work environment, and Morpheus calls and running everything else, everything again has that weird kind of just a subtle green tint to it, which reminded me of Joe versus the Volcano. Because at the beginning of that, everything's done in that fluorescent green, ugly, nasty color.
I've never seen that movie, but okay.
yeah, it reminded me of that. And another key at the beginning in the first scene, of course, is Blade Runner. All the way through, these huge, old, vintagey buildings with lots of rain at nighttime. That's, to me, is very Blade Runner in the way it looks. That's mm-hmm. a key.
I've got a couple of, I guess, movie nod keys. The rooftop sets that Trinity is leaping across were literally the same sets used in Dark City.
Okay. Another good post-apocalyptic counter-reality movie. Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
And there was some controversy there, too, where Dark City was saying Matrix ripped them off. But when you go back to what I was saying about the gestation period of the script, the Matrix was written long before Dark City. So that's not true.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the little nose rubs and the little gesture of the hand before they fight, that's Bruce Lee. They totally are paying homage to Bruce Lee in those, which I think is awesome, because I think Bruce Lee was awesome.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah, I think that's a good one, especially if they do so much martial arts in this anyway.
Right.
That's really good.
Right. So there's a couple of the cinematic keys for you there.
I had the whole Battery Tower awakening birth sequence, blah, 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 is very H.R. Giger, with the tubes being attached to you and the whole kind of biomechanical feel to it. It wasn't as phallic or sexual as Giger, but it was very close, very similar in style to it. Neo's, the room where he lives in the real world is room, not in the real world, in the Matrix, is room 101, which of course is a binary code, but also reminded me of 1984, because that's the torture room. You don't want to get taken to room 101 in the novel 1984, because that's where they torture you for information.
Interesting.
So I thought that was kind of a key that got me there.
Yeah, there's a lot in this movie that is intentional.
Yes.
There's no way there were accidental references.
I definitely think they made references intentionally all the way through.
And this is no exception. You mentioned that Anderson means son of man, but Neo is a Christ figure. So you've got a biblical key in there as well, and not to mention Cypher being Judas. So, you know,
he's
betrayed by Judas or betrayed by Cypher. So you've got a lot of religious allegory in there as well.
And I think they played that up through all three movies.
They do.
Even into the, you know.
Yeah.
Neo is our Christ figure.
Yeah. I haven't seen the other two in a long time. I don't know if I'll read it.
Well, you know, even in the first scene, the white rabbit scene, you know, I think the guy even refers to him as Jesus, or you're my savior, mm-hmm. or whatever, when he gives him the code or whatever he's worked on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah. I think I definitely have another movie key, which is Terminator, just because of the whole story, the history. Basically, you know, according to Morpheus and in Terminator, we create an humans create an AI. That AI ends up becoming smarter and better than them. There's a war. We lose as humans. In Terminator, we're the rebellion that has to go back in time to try to fix it. But in this, we're all hooked up to batteries and used to power the, you know, the machines.
The machines, yeah. Yeah, I had Terminator as well. There, I mean, there's a huge, huge Terminator key as far as the plot.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Harlan Ellison wrote a book called, or a story called I Have No Mouth, But I Must Scream. And it is about artificial intelligence taking over the world, and there's only like four or five people left in the world. So you've got that key there, but you also have the fact that there's a scene where Neo's mouth is literally gone from his face, and he's trying to scream, and he can't.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is the, actually, that's the first, not mystic, that's the first bizarre thing that happens in the movie for Neo's character.
Mm-hmm. When he gets bugged.
Well, even before that, it's you know, they took his mouth away.
Yeah.
Literally. Then they bug him.
Yeah. Yeah, that was intense.
You know, but there's a, okay, so, I have these kind of plot-holy questions all the way through this, and one of those is, why did you need to bug him? It doesn't make sense. Why would you need, you're the biggest computer in the world with these agents, and you have to trace people and track them down and find out where they're going next? Really? You can jump into anybody around you, even miles away, but you can't figure out where this guy is? They can figure out in the real world.
He's a super hacker, David. He can just manipulate.
I don't see why you would have to bug him or search for him. It makes no sense to me.
No.
But there are a couple of those. I mean, it's the idea that, you know, the overall premise, and people have written about this since, you know, the overall premise that humans are batteries makes no logical sense either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that's your whole goal, if you want them to supply you with energy and heat or whatever, then why not just use cows or horses or platypuses? You know, you don't have to give them a matrix that's that extreme, and they still produce the same amount of energy.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to keep them around, kind of thing. But, you know, it makes for a cool, at the time when you're in the, yo, whoa, that's really cool, I'll just go with it, it's great, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. The last key that I have is, we've already mentioned it, really, and it's their own. It's the series Sense8. It's basically about a bunch of pretty people being connected and kicking ass.
I could see that.
Similar theme going there as well. They're superhero in their own way, the same way these people are superheroes in the Matrix. So
yeah, I would posit the kind of not an opposite, but the same kind of corollary to that the Matrix, they have to create this fantasy world for them to be a superhero in. And Sense8, they find out they can be superheroes in their own world, which is more in reality kind of thing. And I really, you know, and that's a genre, that's a subgenre of science fiction that's everywhere now in these limited series and on Netflix everywhere, which is this whole superhero thing of becoming superheroes, or you find out you're a superhero, or you're a teen with superhero powers. And it just seems to be this subgenre that's everywhere now. But Sense8 did it so much, I think, more compelling and in a very unique style to others that have done it.
Yeah, I would agree there. It's not too different than other subgenres, though. I mean, we got inundated with vampire crap, and especially teen vampire crap when... What are those stupid Stardust movies called? Sparkle movies.
Twilight.
Yeah, I can't even think of it. But because
Stardust movies.
And now the superhero movies are turning into, like, you know, young adult teen super movies or whatever. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Subgenres spawn subgenres.
True. True. But I think the movie overall, I mean, handles everything very well. They definitely have great pace all the way through it. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to glance through my notes for different high points I liked. I like the whole opening sequence, the way they tie us in, but have so much mystery we don't know what's going on. Carrie Ann Moss in black leather is never a bad thing. That works for me really well. talk about pretty people in kicking ass.
Right.
The sequence all the way up through, you know, all of the, so all of his essential, both birth one way or the other way, his physical birth into the real world, but also his birth as the hero all the way through, learning the training with Morpheus and then being betrayed, going to the Oracle.
I love that scene, by the way. That's one of my favorites.
I do too, even though logically it makes no sense. Again, you know, you have an obviously, she is a computer program that is so into human psychology that she can make predictions. But she has those as visions, and she's, what? You know, but I do like the fact that it, from the very beginning, that whole scene keeps throwing us off. From the doorknob all the way through the spoon, her as the old lady, the cookies, her attitude. I love the way she, her casting was great, by the way. I thought that was great.
Yeah, her name is, I have it somewhere, Gloria Foster.
Yeah, really good in this part.
I like that above her door it says, "Know thyself," which is what was above the door at the Oracle of Delphi in Greece, or Delphi, some people say.
Yep.
So that's Greek mythology as well. I also like that she says she'll feel better, have a cookie, because cookie in, you know, computer terminology is a piece of data. So I don't know if she was just, you know, erasing a bit of what she told him or whatever. She did something by letting him eat that cookie, which was kind of funny. But back to Keanu.
Oh, my God. Do we have to?
You had mentioned earlier, in the first 45 minutes, Neo has 80 lines, and 44 of them are questions. So that means
no duh.
He averages one question per minute, which is kind of reinforcing his Keanu stereotype.
But he never asks the real questions like, oh, how did I get here? Why am I cast in this?
Why me?
Why do I have a career? Yeah. Why me?
Before the speech at the end, he never has more than 5 sentences together.
Well, it's because he can't read. No, just.
No, it's either they knew they cast him and they cut some of it because it was terrible. Or, I don't know, maybe it was written that way. What do you think?
Oh, my God. I don't know. I think maybe this, they started with their 15th version, but then they cast Keanu and had to go to a 16th, you know, where they cut half the dialogue out or whatever.
Well, and they give Trinity and especially Morpheus these killer lines. Maybe they were trying to dumb him down so that their lines sounded cooler. I don't know.
I'm being the optimist here. Well, and he's, face it, his character is very nebbish all the way through. It's supposed to be. He is learning this world that he doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of factors into it. He would have a lot of questions, and he wouldn't have a lot of instinctive great lines because he doesn't know he's always in denial until near the end. But you're right, I've got one of the lines I even have here that I wrote down was the exchange between Morpheus and Neo right when he's first born and everything else, or first in the real world aboard the Nebuchadnezzar, and he says, "Why do my eyes hurt?" And there's just a brief pause, and then Morpheus goes, "You've never used them before."
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's really cool. Because, mm-hmm. Yeah, you're in the umbilical jelly world, chrysalis. You probably never opened your eyes.
Yeah, it's gross.
Kind of thing. So I do have some trivia stuff.
Okay.
We're kind of jumping around, but some trivia in there, too, like you have. The Ending date on the computer monitor is 9-18-99. When Neo wakes up and he's late for work, his clock says 9-18. At this time, Lily Wachowski's wife, her birthday was 9-18. That's why he put that in there. So
I just thought it might be the release date. Didn't it come out in 99?
It did come out in 99, okay. but the date itself was his wife's birthday. So that's why he kind of put that in there as a throw-in. I thought that was kind of neat.
Mm-hmm. I've got a body count. Body count, body count. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, please, that's good. Body count, go. Yes.
39. And I'm not naming them all.
Right.
That's my horror contribution. Well, that's body count.
You know, and that's something that's kind of like looked over in this movie, but it occurred to me while I was watching it again. So they have a genuine, you know, animosity with the agents. The agents are the bad guys. They're looking for them. Da, da, da. The agents can morph into anybody. When they take over that person, I'm assuming they're still that person. They're just an agent in that person. So when you kill that agent, you're killing that person. Which bothered me a little bit this time watching. I was going, so all these innocent people die. Even then, all the other cops and everybody else, they're just doing their jobs. And they're like killing them, kicking them, shooting them, throwing them off buildings. You know?
And, they're just,
I guess,
a battery.
We're supposed to say, oh, they're just a bad. Yeah,
we'll get another one.
I was just about to say that. Yeah, we'll get another one. You know, just grow another one out and harvest it, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Some other, I guess my last things on here are just the whole, you know, my plot hole questions of stuff like, you know, they have this great sequence where Morpheus goes, power up, we're going in. And then there's all this techno music and we're showing Tank get ready and we're panning around all of them at the same time we're panning around a phone that's ringing inside the Matrix. And we zoom to the very end and suddenly they're all standing there. And Morpheus goes over and answers the phone and goes, we're in. You know, how did that happen? Somebody has to answer the phone for you to get in. You know?
Because it looks cool,
really
David.
Cool scene. I know, but there's cool. So much of that in it that's like, this looks cool, but it makes no sense. How does that not work? You know?
Oh, that's
it's
so
like
funny.
Cypher... You know, Cypher, great scene. I love this steak. It's great. Da, 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 da. It tastes good. How did you get there?
What,
and how are you going to get back?
What is that YouTube guy that does the thing and you told me, oh, no, I can't watch it because he'll destroy the movie for me? You know what I'm talking about?
What now? No.
A few weeks back, I can't remember which movie we were doing. I said, oh my gosh, check this guy out. He's hilarious. And you said, no, I can't watch that. He'll ruin it for me. Because he does what you're saying. He points out all the errors.
Oh, yeah.
I can't think of his name.
Well, there's the one that I like all the time, which is called Everything Wrong.
Something
and
like that.
You just
that,
type it
yeah.
in Everything Wrong With, and he's the guy that does all the counts. Of all the mistakes.
And
in
they're
the
really
movies.
Funny, like video edits. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So you can't do it this way? Yeah. Okay, great. Fine. Thank you. We'll just keep going. I'm going to give you one bad count for that. Yeah. He's
I would
great.
Like to see
I can't remember who edited
that guy's version of The Matrix if he's done one, because I bet it's hilarious.
I'm sure he has. Yeah. I'm sure he has. And then I've got some pluses, too. I mean, I really love. The action sequences, of course, all the way through. I like the final reveal moment of Neo when he realizes the power. I think that's really well told and real done. The rescue of Morpheus, even though it has all those mistakes, still works for me. Establishing the whole fact that they're loading knowledge. The way they do that, this is what we'll need. And suddenly they're in the big white void and all the stuff comes like weapons. And they can pick them up, and then later on, when is it Trinity that can fly the plane, the helicopter?
Yeah.
She goes, "I can
she
now.
Downloads.
Give me a second."
Yeah, she downloads.
Yeah, she phone. Downloads it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that stuff. I like all of that.
Yeah, and I don't know if you knew, but you know, you were talking about green being the Matrix and blue being the real world.
Yeah,
the whole scene where he's teaching Neo how to fight. That scene's done in yellow. Because it's really in neither world.
Oh, in the dojo where they're learning the jujitsu and everything?
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's like the one scene that's shot in a different color.
Well, and my thing, it has these set pieces, as they call them, all the way through that are great. You know, the whole escape from the hotel, the whole rescue of Morpheus, all of that. But it's all based on, we've got to go get Morpheus because they're going to hack into his mind and get the codes to Zion, because every captain has the codes. And it seems like, why wouldn't you just make a phone call to back to Zion saying, hey guys, change the codes. Morpheus has Morpheus got captured. Can you change all the codes? You know, but I guess you, like everyone always tells me when I get critical, they go, then we wouldn't have a movie. So there's that.
David Horton, Destroyer of Worlds.
Destroyer of Worlds. Breaker of logic.
Breaker of logic. Bringer of logic.
Bringer of logic. That's
I come in peace. I bring logic to the movie industry.
And my last, my last key is, and I mentioned this to you before, and we've talked about it before, discussed, I think it's so powerful. There was a Frederick Brown classic science fiction short story called The Answer. And I think Matrix is inspired by it in a way. I think the Wachowskis probably read the short story, because basically in it you've got this think tank, and they're building the world's supercomputer. The biggest, hugest supercomputer in the world. They put all these, but they don't have enough money, so they have to go to the military. And the military, of course, says, yes, we'll be glad to fund your project as long as, you know, we can use it later. And they don't mind. They spend months developing this hardware and this software, and they're finally ready to take the computer online. And everybody's there. The general and the president and all the other top people are there, and they fire up the computer. And as they fire up the computer, outside a storm starts. They don't think anything of it. They just keep doing. The computer powers up and says, hello. They say, well, what are we going to ask it? What's the first question you would ask a supercomputer who has the sum of all human knowledge? And they debate about it. And one guy finally goes, okay, I know what to ask him. You go, okay. And his question is there a God? And as soon as he types it in, lightning flashes outside and the computer comes up and says, there is now. And that's the line. And I've always thought that this reminded me of that, an AI that is so omniscient that when we fire it up, it's smarter than us.
Right.
It starts to take over. So so that was my last little reference of a key kind of thing.
In looking back at the story itself, I mean, you had mentioned that it was a milestone. I didn't realize it when you were talking about it that you thought so highly of it, as far as categorizing it as a paradigm like 2001 or Star Wars. But I have a feeling, when I was talking about casting, I have a feeling there's a lot of jokers out there that read this script and went, oh my God, I don't understand this, or this is too much. People can't handle it. But I did note that Larry Fishburne, or Lawrence Fishburne, he's not my best friend. he thought the film at first was too smart to be made. But then I watched a making of behind the scenes thing last night, which was really interesting, because you're seeing the Wachowskis run around as guys, and they're clearly women now. And when they talk to him, he's like, this movie is going to be huge, and I am so glad that I am a part of it, because it is a very, intelligent movie that's never been done before. This kind of story has never been done before on film.
Yep, I agree.
And I just thought that was kind of cool that he had that. At least, he was cool enough to see that when he was offered the script. I have a feeling
someone like Val
Kilmer probably went, what? No. Yeah.
Well, I think it's hugely cerebral. You have to be willing to accept the first conceit, which is everything in your reality is wrong.
Right.
And then see it from a different parallel existence. And I think that set up this whole dynamic of changing the viewer's point of view. You know, and they do it again, like, you know, they do it in Cloud Atlas. They do it in Jupiter Ascending. But they started this whole sub-genre, I guess, if we say that, of science fiction, of your reality is not what you think it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Alice in Wonderland of science fiction stories.
I think 12 Monkeys is a little that way, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, big time.
I think 12 Monkeys is definitely that, yeah.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen that, and I remember really liking that movie. I would definitely do a podcast to that movie just to watch it again.
Yep, that's definitely on our sci-fi list.
But back to what we were saying as far as the intelligence or Where No Man Has Gone Before aspect. Last night, I was with my husband, Dennis, he said, you need to watch a movie for tomorrow, don't you? I said, yeah, but you can watch it. It's not a horror movie because he's not big on horror movies. And he said, what is it? I said, it's The Matrix. He said, oh, no, I don't understand that movie. He said, I tried that movie.
What? Really?
Yeah, no, he's not into it. He's a kind of a Brit file, you know. He would rather watch Downton Abbey or anything like Keeping Up Appearances. He's not into the sci-fi horror world really at all. So,
okay.
Yeah. He did watch Walking Dead with me for a while, and then Negan came, and that was the end of that. So.
Yep, I can understand that. That was a turning point in that series, I think. Yeah. So,
but anyway, any last thoughts or
last thoughts of despite Keanu, this is a great science fiction film. It's a heck of a ride, great action, but not just action for action's sake. There's some story to it.
Yeah, it's a hybrid movie, really. It's sci-fi and action and superhero.
Yep. Yeah. Ignore the sequels and just enjoy this, because the sequels kind of gradually get worse and worse as they progress.
As sequels
and,
do.
Enjoy it.
Yeah.
Yes. Cool.
All right. So I guess we're going to get out of here for this week. We'd like to thank everybody for tuning in to Johnny Has the Keys. Be sure to subscribe, like, and rate us on your podcast app of choice. And we got Facebook pages and Twitter pages and Instagram pages.
Yes.
Whatever page you're into, we'd like to see you there.
Like us, subscribe us, review us, email us.
Make us your bitches.
There we go.
Oops, did I say that?
All right, see you next time, Tim.
All right, man, bye.